It is 26 minutes after the hour. It is a Thursday morning, a therapeutic Thursday, and we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie, an Anglican pastor with his church in Fairfax, Virginia, lives in Ashburn, Virginia, and he is the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. Thought I'd better mention that, too, because it's quite some ministry. We're going to talk about synagogues, and not just synagogues generally, but synagogues specifically, referring to the town of Nazareth, Jesus' hometown, and what he did there. But I want to talk just for a second about synagogues, the building itself. I think we have the notion that they're churches around Israel, and that's the function of a synagogue. Seems to me it was like a public building, and as for education, that's probably where the Midrash, the school for kids, was held. So it was for education, and there may have been, well, obviously, because perfect example is Jesus in the synagogue in Nazareth reading from Scripture, but that's not the same as the temple. It had a different function than the temple. And in Israel at that time, education was religion, was the Hebrew Bible, and was memorizing the Bible. That was education. So these were really public schools, weren't they?
Definitely. I mean, think community center. When I grew up in South Carolina, we had a community park, and it was called Woodhill Park. And we would go there, and there was a basketball court, a pool table, and you could check out games. There were restrooms. There were different things that you could do there. And people converged upon the park. And we would meet there. We'd ride our bicycles there. And we would go there throughout the week. And there would always be something going on there to draw a crowd.
Must have been before TV, my guess.
Back when we rode our bikes, pre-cell phone and internet, that stuff. Back when our parents said, come back home when the street lights come on. Mm-hmm. You know, the good old days when we left our houses, you know, and actually spoke with one another. Yeah, but that's kind of the picture. The synagogue in the first century was a community center. It was a place of learning. It was like a school, though school happened all the time. I mean, think about what it says in Deuteronomy. Talk about the law, bind it upon your foreheads, put it on your hands. Talk about it when you walk along the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. The house was the home of learning. The homeschool was the norm. And so everyone was learning all the time from each other. Now, the synagogue was more of a formal place to learn, and kids would go there throughout the week to learn, to study, to read. But mainly, if they weren't working with their families, either if you're female in the home with your mother learning the household chores.
Yeah, the girls would have not gone to school, right?
Well, they would have. They would have gone on the Sabbath day. That's hotly debated. Were women allowed in the synagogue? And the answer is yes, because you're not talking about the temple.
Well, I'm talking about kids being educated, though. It seemed to me the emphasis was on males, young yeah. boys. They would actually memorize the Hebrew Bible word for word. They would go to the school was called the Midrash, and would be taught by, I don't know if it was a full-fledged rabbi, might have been, but a learned teacher who would read to them, because there weren't a whole lot of books, and I'm not sure that everybody could read, but it was an oral culture, and they responded to what they heard, and they seized on that, and they retained it.
Sure. And in terms of formal learning, that's one thing, but when you think about the culture and the patterns of learning and teaching, that's everyone. So especially in the house. Now, on Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath being sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday, Sabbath morning around 10 or 11 o'clock, the entire village would gather around the local synagogue. Hmm. Anyone who was closest to that synagogue would gather and learn. There would be reading from the Torah, reading from the law, and a discussion. And that would be every Sabbath day. the reading of the scrolls. So families would go there, and that would be a time of questioning and learning. Now,
but it wasn't churches. We know it.
No. And see, there's debate here, and I disagree with some of the folks. When I was doing work over at a Museum of the Bible, we had a recreation of the synagogue in Nazareth. We had a recreation village of Jesus of Nazareth. It was modeled after the Magdala synagogue. Now, it's the first one, because we've actually discovered, archaeologists, not we, I wasn't there, but archaeologists have discovered two synagogues in Magdala, not one, but two. And the first one unearthed what's called the Magdala Stone, which there's debate on what it was used for. Did people stand on it? Was there a table there? Was that where they read from the Torah scroll? We actually had a recreation of the Magdala Stone in the Nazareth Synagogue at Museum of the Bible. But there's no synagogue discovered in Nazareth. Now, we know there was one because the scriptures tell us, but there's debate on whether or not there was, quote, worship there. Now, I have a view of worship that's a little bit more all-encompassing. My view of worship is that worship is a posture. It's what you are to do with your life all the time. Hmm. And I believe what I'm reading and understanding about first century Judaism, that's their posture too. Even Jesus at the Great Commission, of course, you'll make disciples as you go along your way. That idea that we're always learning, we're always making disciples, we're always students, we're always in a posture of learning and teaching and growth, which I believe is worship. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength, with all of who you are all the time. So with that caveat and that definition of worship, I believe there was worship in the synagogue. Now, what there wasn't in the synagogue, there was not sacrifice. And one of my talking points at museum, most people didn't know what a synagogue was who walked in. I mean, the average person looks at that and they say, is this the temple? Hmm. And I would say, no, the temple's in Jerusalem. There's one temple. There are many synagogues. Matter of fact, there were synagogues in every major city, every major village. And in the case of Magdala, there were two synagogues.
And in the case of Nazareth, which was kind of a hick town in the hills, it was a small town, relatively insignificant, except for us in the presence of Jesus and Mary and Joseph and this episode in the synagogue. But it was a small place. We would call it Country Bumpkinville, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. A few hundred people.
The people were different there, too.
Yeah. Yeah, a few hundred people, and if we look at Luke chapter 4, if we just go over to just one gospel account of Jesus teaching in the synagogue, in Luke chapter 4, beginning at verse 14, it says, "And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and a report went about him all throughout the surrounding country, and he taught in their synagogues." Now, synagogues here is plural, meaning there are multiple synagogues throughout the Galilee region, and he taught in all of them.
And this was the early part of his ministry, correct?
Right, and we don't see this. We don't see the word all here in this particular passage, but we do see that synagogue is plural. So we can assume that everywhere we found a synagogue, or everywhere, I say we, archaeologists have found a synagogue in the region of Galilee, Jesus was there and he taught, providing that synagogue dates back to the first century. Hmm. And in the case of, say, Capernaum, where Jesus made his home as an adult, we have a first century foundation of a synagogue with a later synagogue built upon the top of the basalt foundation. And that top synagogue is actually limestone, where the lower foundation, and I've been there and seen it, is basalt, which is the volcanic harder stone. But the first century synagogue is there. It's there in Capernaum, and you can go to it. The Magdala synagogues, both of them, you can go there. There's also one in Chorazin and Bethsaida, and you can go there. And there are later synagogues over in Gamala as well. And our friends over at BiblePlaces.com have done a wonderful job putting together slides of that. And they have these synagogues pictured actually in the slide. The one at Chorazin has a seat of Moses, a recreation one. The other one is in a museum, in the Israel Museum. But that one dates back to the first century and is basalt stone as well.
Now, is it fair to say, because the Galilee region is populated both by observant Jews, Hellenistic Jews, and a whole lot of Gentiles, including Romans, and it was a trade center. Capernaum was. There were people from all around the world, all around the Middle East, and even in Eastern Europe, and then from Egypt and African places. It appears from this that Jesus' priority was observant Jews. It's kind of like Paul, the first place he would go would be the synagogue. Is that a fair assumption that he was targeting observant Jews first early in his ministry?
Yeah, absolutely. But the interesting fact is there are ruins and archaeological leftovers throughout even the Gentile region. There's been, like say in Gamala, for instance, there is remains of a synagogue dating back. This synagogue actually dates back to the late 60s, but it was also used in the first century AD. But it dates back as far as the 60s, and you can see the footprint of this, and it's overlooking the hills of Galilee. And so we know that there are Gentiles there. Kiria Bat Shema is another one, and some other ones that I can't necessarily pronounce very well. But they're all over Galilee. And again, our key here is verse 14. That he went about throughout all the surrounding country. That says all. And then verse 15 of Luke 4, and he taught in their synagogues, plural. And then again, if you go over to a later passage, you can look, say, at Matthew 9:35. If you go to Matthew 9:35 in the English Standard Version, it says, Jesus went throughout all the cities, all, and the villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. If that's true, that he indeed went to all the first century villages and preached in their synagogues or taught in their synagogues, that means that you can bet that if you are in a first century synagogue anywhere in Galilee, Jesus was there.
And that would be, because it's at the beginning of his ministry, that would be the best place to get a reputation, to get known, to get, he must have been like a rock star, you know, by the time he got to Nazareth.
Yeah, because it would be the elder, more wiser people. And if you don't think of 30, not in our culture, you don't think of 30 as being elderly and wise, but in that culture, 30 is ripe.
Well, I understand the average lifespan of a male first century Israel was like in the mid 40s. So you were aged if you reached that point, and probably not long for the world, considering all the accidents and diseases and combat and warfare. Life was quick.
Sure. So the synagogue is a place of learning. It's a place of hospitality. It's a place to read the Torah and to talk about it, which I would say that's worship. It was also a place of hospitality in that travelers, it was almost the overflow. If a town or a village was filled, like if there were no room in people's homes, you could sleep there at night. A traveler could sleep in the synagogue at night. It would be used kind of like the park analogy that I gave you, the local community center or the local community park. It would be used throughout the week. It would be occupied at any given time and used for all kinds of different purposes, almost like a multi-purpose room.
The Bible talks about the president of the synagogue in various places. So there must have been a civic organization maybe who would operate.
A ruler or and caretaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And you see that again. We can go back to the text in Luke 4. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And this is a key verse. This is verse 16. And as was his custom. Like that little sentence, as was his custom, comma, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day. So we know that this is a custom. We know that this is what all observant Jews did. And he stood up to read.
But surely he would have been invited to do so.
Absolutely. Hmm. Because if the synagogue's filled, not just anybody or everybody's going to have a chance to read. It's you don't even see that in an open mic night. If you go to a local coffee shop, mm-hmm. not everybody there is going to have an opportunity to perform or to read. You have a list and you get on the list, and when your name's called, you go up and you do that. And so we can assume that Jesus is chosen as this particular reader at this particular time. And so he goes up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him, and it was unrolled. As he unrolled the scroll, he found the place where it was written, and we'll read that in a minute. But he rolled up the scroll in verse 20 and gave it back to the attendant. So the role you're speaking of could have been the attendant of the synagogue. And so he's there. He's there in the text, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you read the text in its context and say, who is this attendant? And
he would have prearranged to have, he knew he was going to do Isaiah. And very possibly so did the people in the gallery, the audience, I want to call them a congregation, the group of people who were there to listen to him. This was probably not off the cuff.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, he intentionally chose Isaiah.
Or it was their set reading for that particular day.
Oh, that could be.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he used it. Now, let's back up before we even get into Isaiah and where did the synagogue come from? I mean, that's a question we haven't asked, because really worship is to be done at the temple primarily. Now, you know my stance on it, and it could be controversial. I think worship happens everywhere, and including in the synagogue. But in terms of sacrifice, that only happens at the temple. So where does synagogue meeting and reading and potentially worship, where does that even come from? And most scholars believe it goes back to the exile. When the temple is destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC, and there's a dispersion of the Jewish people throughout the countryside. They're taken captive to Babylon. Even in the attack of the north by the Assyrians in 722, when the Assyrians would conquer and settle your land, where the Babylonians would take you with them. When the Jewish people are dispersed, they would begin to gather to read from the Torah, to read from the law. And so you had to have a place, a designated place to do this. And so these synagogues began to be developed and then existed at the resettling 70 years later, around 515. So when the Israelites come back under Ezra and
Nehemiah
mm-hmm. and they begin to rebuild the city walls, rebuild the Temple Mount, and reinstitute temple worship, these synagogues are popping up all around as places of reading. And by the time Jesus shows up on the scene, they're everywhere.
They probably popped up wherever Jews were, including the diaspora. People who have spread were removed by the Assyrians, for example, or the Babylonians, and scattered around the Middle East. I guess building a synagogue by then would have been a high priority to hold the culture together.
Yeah. Yeah. And people in place. I mean, it's interesting the role that, say, church buildings in our time play. And as we see like a almost post-Christian era developing in Europe and even in our society, I mean, there's conversions of old churches, particularly in the United Methodist tradition, where these churches are being turned into condos. And they had a role in place, and then they cease to have that role when the culture shifts. And so the temple was the place. And when the temple was destroyed and the people were dispersed, other places began to emerge where people would gather. Starbucks is the same way. Starbucks was famous for being what's called a third place. The Starbucks would pop up and it would be not your house, not my house, but Starbucks. We'll meet over there. And Starbucks actually had a policy where you didn't have to buy anything. You could go into any Starbucks and meet and gather. And Starbucks became like the 20th century and 21st century meeting place, gathering place, the point of gathering. And even that shifted. The culture shifted with inflation. Starbucks just announced that you, if you're going to be in a Starbucks, you must buy something. Mm-hmm. Now that's a culture shift. And I know what you're, I mean, we're on the radio talking about first century synagogues, and all of a sudden we're talking about synagogues, what in the world's happening. It's relevant. The church, the Starbucks, the local Starbucks actually was mirroring or mimicking or filling a void for a post-church age. So the church was supposed to be epic, E-P-I-C. And I get this from the biblical scholar and professor Leonard Sweet, who wrote The Gospel According to Starbucks. And Leonard Sweet said that the church is supposed to be experiential, participatory, image-rich, and communal. So let's just assume that the temple in Jerusalem and every synagogue was epic. It's experiential, it's participatory, it's image-rich, and it's communal. That's the definition. I mean, that's the definition, by the way, of liturgy, the work of the people. When we gather to worship, when the Jewish people gather to worship, there's no spectators. Everybody's involved. Everybody goes there. Everybody participates. It's experiential. We're together. We're doing it together. We're doing it in place, and it's participatory. We're active in that. So the whole Anglican tradition, stand, sit, kneel, you know, liturgical calisthenics. Everybody's in it. And then experiential, participatory, image rich, there's imagery. What do you know about the tabernacle? There's the table, the showbread, the menorah, the altar of incense. There's the Ark of the Covenant back there. All of that's happening. And it's happening in the synagogue, too. You have a table. You have attendance. You have a place. You roll out the scroll. Somebody reads it. There's a place to sit down. It's image rich, and it's communal. The community does it together. Now, people are going to find place to gather because the church is where the people of God gather. The synagogue is where the Jewish people gather, the people of God gather. And it's where they read, and they were actively engaging in life together and worship together. Now, as the culture changes, so does the place. And so we even see this throughout the Old Testament. God walked with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. There's your place. There's the gathering. The Exodus. God led his people, pillar of cloud by day, fire by night, and they built a tabernacle, a tent. And that place moved. It's almost like the church with wheels on, or the worship space with wheels on. We travel with it. We go where it goes. We go where God leads us. It's nomadic. And then in the conquering and the settling of the land, we see David desiring to build God a specific place, of a specific temple in a specific place. And then Solomon builds that place. And then when it's destroyed in 586, the synagogues begin to pop up. And synagogues still exist today in the 21st century. We worshiped in some of them during the pandemic. We had some electrical problems in our church, and synagogues opened the door. And, hey, they didn't need the place on Sunday because their worship is on Saturday. So these places are everywhere. And so the church now the location of the people of God. You get these mega church buildings and they're communicating something in their style. You get home churches and that's communicating something in the style. Synagogues have changed. Now, you know, they look different, but they're kind of the same. And then again, gosh, I'm going next week. I'll be at an exponential conference on worship and ministry in business. So using the place, the physical bricks and mortar of economy to be hubs of ministry.
Interesting, too, as we get into Roman times, the Basilica was a public building where records were kept and political speeches were made. And authorities were able to decree this, to decree that, and kind of govern the population. After the Roman Empire folded and the Roman Catholic Church took over and really changed the place that you just talked about. Now there's a stage, an audience, it's and they still refer to them as basilicas, you know, the classic buildings.
One of the things that we're doing this year, this summer, is we have the annual Manna for Malawi fundraiser, and it's always been in bars and restaurants because that's where we've had the space. This year, we're going to have it at the church.
Ah.
We're going to put the music up in the parking lot, and we're going to have activities inside the church. The fellowship hall will have the silent auction.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah, I mean it's going to change the way that the community, this little tiny town of Crosby, sees this church building. That's going to change. And
yep.
I don't think we've totally appreciated that. It's not till August, but I think slowly but slowly we're going to start to realize, oh, these people are going to look at our church differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
these people have music there. Oh my gosh, outside dancing. Oh.
And the architecture of a church, the space dictates how you worship and. Mm-hmm. It communicates, you know, the old cathedrals. I mean, you know, Washington Cathedral's been in the news here lately, but that cathedral says something. The architecture, the flying buttresses, the reaching and soaring up to the heavens, the way the floor plan is, the nave, the sanctuary, all of these different pieces of the architecture. But now even these mega churches, it's a sage on the stage and everybody faces in one direction and everybody sits there and receives.
Comes from the old basilicas, yeah.
Well, that also mimics a consumeristic society. It's like going to see a movie. I don't participate. I just sit there. And that information comes at me. And I'm not engaged in it at all. I pay to play. I go and sit and receive, and then I go home. And that's very passive. And to me, it shows the decline of the church today because it's lost its rootedness and its purpose, say, from the synagogues back in the first century. And I think that we would do well to go back to that model, that synagogue house church model, and get back to being epic, experiential, participatory, image rich, and communal.
And one way to learn about it is take a look at Luke 4 and read through that passage on Jesus in the synagogue in Nazareth. And it kind of echoes what we've just been talking about in terms of a public building. And Robbie, I'm a little disturbed by the way churches, I know years ago I said, I'm tired of this form of worship, was give me a house church. And we managed to find one when we moved to Texas, and it was just a world of difference. All of a sudden, we were part of a family, you know? Everybody took part. Everybody
can't hide. Part. Can't no. hide in that yeah. environment.
Yeah. Robbie, again, the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, want to mention their website to you, preservingbibletimes.org. Their specialty as a ministry is to present to you the context of the Bible, particularly the Gospels, but really the whole Bible, social, cultural, historic, linguistic, different aspects of context, illuminates what you read in the Bible, helps you read between the lines and understand, grasp the full meaning, the original meaning of everything that's there. So pay them a visit, preservingbibletimes.org. If you're listening on BrokenRoadRadio.com, you can link to it over on the right-hand side of the homepage. You'll see a Preserving Bible Times logo there. So, Robbie, thanks so much for what you bring. We'll look forward to next week.
Joy, privilege, and a pleasure always to be on the Broken Road with Jim David. Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.